Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Science, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Galina Limarenko, doctoral candidate in neuroscience with a focus on biochemistry and molecular biology of neurodegenerative diseases at BFL in Switzerland, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Kati Berner about her new book, Atlas of Forecasts, Modeling and Mapping Desirable Futures. To envision and create the futures we want, society needs an appropriate understanding of the likely impact of alternative actions. Data models and visualizations offer a way to understand and intelligently manage complex interlinked systems in science and technology, education, and policymaking. Atlas of Forecasts, from the creator of the Atlas of Science and Atlas of Knowledge, shows how we can use data to predict, communicate, and ultimately attain desirable futures. Well, Kati, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Galina. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you here today with us. So as we have witnessed the unprecedented times of the recent global pandemic, I was wondering if you could start by reflecting on how has it affected you and your work, and maybe some main takeaways that you've gathered from this experience.
As you might have seen, we care deeply about data literacy, people being able to not just read data properly, but make their own data visualizations. And with the new book, also to make their own models of data so that they can ideally predict the future a little bit. And it, I have to say that thanks to COVID, many bad things have happened, but also some good things have happened. And maybe that's the optimist in me, because there are so many grim things that really, really impacted people's lives, loved ones being gone, and people losing their jobs. But in all of this, there are some good nuggets. And one of them is that people had to learn how to read graphs, data graphs of cases in their own local communities, or worldwide number of deaths, or number of people that now have COVID. And that all impacted our lives in massive ways. I think we all are very social animals, and now being not able to see our loved ones and friends and family members, especially if they're far away, and especially if you have to take a flight to go somewhere, is hard. So I think in our world, we actually see much improvement in terms of how people can deal with data and how they understand predictions and how they understand visualizations.
So can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, happy to. So I grew up in Germany. I did an engineering degree in Leipzig, my hometown. And I'm absolutely a maker. I like to build things. I like to build tools that others can use to create their own data visualizations, not just give them a visualization, but help them look at their own data, personal or professional data, in new ways. And it's wonderful for me that I can actually realize this dream, that we have a team here that has many professional programmers and many students that build tools for others. But then going on in my own career, so I went and did a PhD in artificial intelligence, and that was fascinating. So this is many, many years back in time. And I really loved to see how human and machine intelligence could be combined to do things that neither of them could do alone. But then I actually had my first child, and I realized that there's a long way to go between what machine learning algorithms can do and what this little baby in my arms could do. And I decided that maybe it takes too long to actually get to something that is as smart as what we human beings are right now. And that in the meantime, it would be much more beneficial to create intelligence amplifiers. So you just twirl the AI into IA. And these intelligence amplifiers, they would help us make better decisions at home, at work, in all kinds of environments. And so my team has been focusing over the last 20 plus years on creating data visualizations that make a difference and that ultimately help us all to get to more desirable futures.
So thinking about your path through your university or college, were there any mentors or colleagues that really helped you along the way? And perhaps you could give advice to some early career researchers?
Absolutely. I think I was very, very lucky to have colleagues that got curious and interested and ultimately excited about what was going on. And they absolutely opened doors to me. They had wonderful advice. And I think you absolutely must have these strong partners in your life to help you really understand where to go and where not to go, where the dragons are on the old maps of the world. And having this kind of network is incredibly important. Now, being older and wiser, I think that what everybody should do, as a PhD student or anyone really, it doesn't have to be in the academic setting, also in just real life. I think it's really good to ask some of the people that you admire and that you think they got it all figured out to just become mentors to you. And again, this could be in professional lives or in your private life. And there will be times in your life when you absolutely need to make that call and you need to get their advice because you just don't know if you should do the A route or the B route. And they might suggest a C route, which you didn't see before. So reaching out proactively to those that you admire and asking them, could you mentor me? Could you be a guide for me in this very complex world is a really great idea. And I have seen this many times now happening to me where people reached out to me and asked me to be their mentor. And I thought, man, I should have done this more proactively when I had my initial career.
That's an excellent advice. So your curiosity and very deep insight into the world of data is beautifully captured in your book, Atlas of Forecasts. So can you tell us what is it about and how did you come to writing it?
Yes, of course. So the Atlas came out 2 days ago. I actually got the first book to be held in my hands today. So this is great timing for the interview. And it's wonderful, but it's also 8 years of work. And you sometimes think about what else you could have done in those 8 years. But I think I'm very absolutely proud. And it's a team effort, as I think every book is. There's very barely a single person who could do it alone. I think they always get inspired by people they talk to, they work with, they interact with on a daily basis, or just sometimes just one time, and it really changes the way you think. And so this particular book, The Atlas of Forecasts, it's the third atlas in a series of atlases. So there's the Atlas of Science, the Atlas of Knowledge, and now the finishing touch to the trilogy is the Atlas of Forecasts. And this book really tries to help people understand the power of models and maps together, combined. So as you already alluded to, in a time of a pandemic, which we all live through, it's really important to not just see what happened over the last year or the last week, but to try to get an understanding of what might happen over the next week or over the next month. Many of us, we need to plan. We need to figure out how we get to see our family members again. We need to plan for our work. We need to make decisions if IU, the university I work with and at, should open or not, should open the campus for face-to-face instruction and research or should stay closed and everything is still online. These are critical and important decisions when we need to make them. And in these cases, computational predictive models come in. And in some cases, it's expert panels which you can query and use to give you advice. But in many cases, it's a lot of data that gets crunched, for instance, at the Center for Disease Control or many other agencies around the globe, and in many research labs as well. And all this data has to be computed and compiled in a way that human experts can make sense of it. And then there needs to be a second step of translation where you need to communicate it to a much more general audience, to my parents, to my children, to anyone, others, many that are out there and that need to make better decisions in their life. So how do you do this best? So the book actually opens with the question, why model? And there are many good reasons why you might like to have a good model. And the book also goes back to times when there were oracles that people queried. The Oracle of Delphi, for instance. People always wanted to know what happens in the future, and they always had different ways to get to answers. And some of those answers were correct, and others were more guesswork. But today we have so much data and good algorithms and compute power that we can actually get ourselves a better understanding of what is likely going to happen. So the book is all about models, and it tries to get models understood by a general audience. So that's why it also took so much time to write it, because it's non-trivial to introduce formulas to general audiences. I think many of them have seen formulas in mathematics courses, and they didn't necessarily like them back then, and they might be happy not to be needing them ever again in their lives. However, most of the readers will have used Amazon, and there are definitely predictions of what else you might like if you just purchase something. Many of the readers might have played video games and computer games, and there's a lot of computational algorithmic involved in ultimately telling people what or to have you play against the computer.
Mm.
And there are many other predictions, including weather predictions and COVID predictions that people use almost on a daily basis.
So your book is really stunning in its presentation with so many excellent illustrations, but it also delivers quite a lot of information in it, which is very, very accessible to general public. So can we delve into the science part a little bit? And can you describe some of the examples of the models? Because not all of them are equivalent, are they?
That's correct, yes. So the Atlas is organized on a double page spread manner. So every time you turn a page, you get a different topic oftentimes. And you can just cherry pick also if you like. So there are sessions which just show you models that matter, that really made a true positive difference, that were used by policymakers or by educators or by scientists to really help our collective understanding of a topic. You have, for instance, on page 9, if you hold the book in your hand, different models that, for instance, communicate Ebola risks, talking about the pandemic, the evaluation of travel restrictions and how far they make a difference or not, and how they should be put in place so that we still can travel, but at the same time do it safely. You also have another map that shows short distances to large gaps in healthcare in New York City. Apparently, where you live in New York helps very concretely to predict how healthy you might be and how long you might live, which is a little scary to realize this. And of course, these are general predictions. This is not one person, but in average, on general, that is actually a good indicator. And it's really sometimes astonishing, sometimes scary to see what these models predict. But in many cases, the predictions are actually accurate, and we have to deal with the aftermath of understanding what they mean. You might also go then to the part 2, which is entitled Methods, and you get to see quite a few overviews of how models typically come into existence. You will get to see that many, many people have to communicate and collaborate closely in order to get a good model to come into existence. And oftentimes it's a subject matter domain expert who really understands, for instance, how COVID evolves over time and how spreading patterns work. And then you would have a modeler who converts this all in a computational predictive model. And the Atlas itself explains 10 different types of models, and there are many more, but we picked 10 and explained those in detail. And then you need a computational scientist who can program these models and make them efficient and really implement them on the cloud so that they can run and do model predictions. And then the code results have to be translated back to the modeler, who then translates that all back to the domain expert so that wise decisions can be made. And often the domain expert, let's say it's an epidemiologist, then needs to communicate this to the decision makers, which might be politicians, local decision makers, university heads, which really have to make these quite important decisions these days.
I really love this interdisciplinary approach that models generally require. So even if you're studying biology, for example, but you want to contribute to environmental science, you might be able to do it because there's just so many ways that you can, is it?
Yeah, it is. And actually, many of the models that are featured in the Atlas are coming from other domains. So for instance, the flows of goods or the information on how diseases spread have inspired models on the diffusion of knowledge, on the diffusion of reputation, on the diffusion of how expertise is given from one generation of scholars to the next generation. So we can learn from other sciences on how to model science, technology, education, and policy data, and still also help advance the original models, because every single new domain gives new insights in how to extend these models, how to use them, when not to use them, which is also very important, and how to communicate the results. So one piece that you already alluded to is how to use data visualizations to communicate the structure and runs of these models, but also to communicate the results of the model runs. And so in the book, you will see hundreds of ways to visualize modeling results. And sometimes they use geospatial maps and overlay patterns of diffusion. In other cases, they show timelines and show how different types of entities evolve over time, interconnect or not connect over time. So network growth and change over time is one of those examples. But you also get to see other types of visualizations that have been used successfully to communicate modeling results. And it's really my hope that many get to just browse the book and get new inspirations of how to model and visualize their own data.
So how much confidence can we put into models? So do you agree with the saying that all models are wrong, but some are useful?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think models come with confidence intervals. So there are models which are very likely true, because this has been a 200-year-old trend. It's very unlikely that even major disruptions will make a change there. But then there are other models, like, for instance, of the stock market or housing market, etc., that might be impacted in radical ways by some of the events that are going on around our globe. So I think there are systems which are rather stable, and then there are systems which are not as stable. And so just understanding the difference between different systems is incredibly valuable. And in the book also, you will again find ways that different stakeholders have used to communicate to each other what kind of trust should be put on a model, and how it can be, how a model can be successfully used, and how it should not be used. And so I think, again, communicating cleanly what the assumptions are that go into a model design, what the limitations are of this model that is currently developed, what kind of validation tests were run with the model, and which ones were not run because there was no time or resources available for those, that is also very important to understand. And again, there are also models in our world which just have to be 99.99% accurate, because life depends on it. And then there are other models where people just want to have a general understanding of how a system might react and work. And those might not be validated at that level of rigor.
So do you have any favorite models that were implemented in practice?
Absolutely. And it's I think, really tough to actually pick favorites here. So I'm going to shy away from that. But what you see in the book is that there are many types of ways that models could be implemented. One of them are just mathematical models, and those are sets of equations. And one model that many of the readers might be very familiar with are rapid and wolf populations, where as rabbits are growing, then wolf, of course, also have more to eat, and then maybe they eat all the rabbits, which then leads to deaths for both types of species. And so on. So these models can be very well prescribed by just writing down equations. And they can, of course, also be simulated using computational algorithms. So that's something that you could do in NetLogo. Actually, anyone can do this by just going to the NetLogo website and picking that predator-prey model type, and then just seeing what different parameter values do to the run of the model and to the ultimate outcome. But you could also take some other models, and you can build physical models. So when I visited the Miraikan Science Museum in Tokyo, Japan, they have a beautiful model of global warming, which is a very physical model, which uses balls and tracks where these balls run along, and different metaphors to ultimately help us all understand the impact of different parameters on how we will or not will be able to manage global warming and make a difference to it. And I think many of us have been affected by major flooding, by wildfires and heat waves going across Europe. I think we hopefully got the message that something is awfully wrong and that we need to do something. And again, models can help us all understand the quite intricate, complex networks that exist between the different entities that we need to understand better in order to make a positive difference.
Oh, that's a really beautiful example of a physical model of the climate change.
Yeah, so if you are in Tokyo, if you happen to be in Tokyo, visit the Miraikan, and it's a very, very physical, very beautifully designed model.
So you made a very important point earlier on that we need to know when the model is good, but we also need to know when the model is not really performing as it should be. So are there any examples of models that were not really optimal or were not really useful, or other ways how can we know when they're not?
Yeah, so there are some models where I couldn't track down the ultimate source credits, and still I think they are great examples of what can go wrong if you use models. So, for instance, there were decision makers in Asia which thought it is a great idea to help with the problem of having too many snakes, poisonous snakes in the environment, by simply paying citizens to bring these snakes to an official place to ultimately contain them there. And the result was ultimately that citizens caught snakes, brought them to the place, the officially dedicated place. But then also to quickly realize that this was a great way to make money, started breeding snakes, and ultimately the officials realized that this was going on, shut down the program, and then the effect was, of course, that people which had been raising snakes let them go. With the effect that there were even more snakes than to begin with. So I think some of these predictions of what might be a good idea can go awfully wrong. And it is the beauty of models, really, that many people can look at possible futures that are predicted by experts, by computational algorithms, or even by physical models, and say, yeah, this is what I understand how this system works, or we actually missed a critical factor, for instance, that people are very creative, innovative, and that they will very likely try to make money by breeding snakes. And therefore, it might not work. So I think models and model visualizations oftentimes can help us get a much better understanding of these complex interdependent systems, which we couldn't gain otherwise if we just hold it all in our single heads and are not able to communicate to each other what system dynamics might actually exist. And so models by themselves, plus the visualizations of these models, so that multiple stakeholders can all come around a square or a roundish table and really look at it and really agree, yep, this is how this is likely going to work. And we have two options and we are going to pick A because it seems to be the most desirable future and most likely outcome that we want. And then implementing it. And then while the model is running and while new data is coming in, computational steer the model to now take on this new data and really help people understand that it's going in the right direction, or it might go in a direction which wasn't anticipated, and then additional decisions might have to be made. So I think in many, many areas, be it a prediction of career trajectories, be it predictions of how students make it through a course and which student might need how much hand-holding or what kind of course material structure and sequence is best for what kind of type of learner. That's another type of model we are working on. But also ultimately understanding how to create innovations, you know, what types of funding might be most useful there. Should it be a workshop which brings together the brightest minds and some young folks as well? Or should it be a very focused research project? Or should it be a project that generates data or algorithms? Oftentimes, funder have these options, and they need to understand and evaluate ultimately what option is best, was best, will be best in the future, because times change, and what's good today might not be the best for tomorrow.
So is this the significance of descriptive models as opposed to predictive models, for example, like maps that just really allows you to visualize the data?
Yeah. So there could be predictive models that are just that have nothing to do with data visualizations. And similar, there could be descriptive models which never get visualized, not even a bar graph or the line graph or any of this. So the difference between the two is really that the descriptive models try to take old data, as I would call it, and there could even be data from today in there. Let's say we are making a prediction of the news. Is it getting more depressive or not? Maybe that's not a good way of doing it. But let's say we want to predict if there is a positive or a pessimistic tone in news. So you take all the news over the last week and including today, as much as you can get it up to the point right now, and you start analyzing this in a linguistic way, and you do sentiment analysis, and you ultimately identify words that are more positive and on the optimistic side, and those words which are more on the pessimistic side. So this all can be done, and you can just get a model for this, which is descriptive of the data that you have seen. Now, if you have that data, you could also use a predictive model, and you could try to predict, given the trend that you see in the usage frequency of these words, for instance, is it going upwards? And maybe it's also continuing to go upwards or downwards, same, or just being level might be continuing like this. But of course, there can always be external factors, a major crisis happening somewhere close by that then increase or decrease the depression or happiness levels in a certain data set, taking this example further. But for the predictive models, I think there are very, very good models that now exist that can be used to help us understand very likely futures, again, with confidence intervals, and not for a single person, but in general. And so these kind of predictive models are incredibly valuable for then running all kinds of services that, again, most people use on a daily basis, be it from the predictions that you get by Google on your news feeds, be it Amazon again, be it what Facebook brings up in terms of advertisement, and so on and so on. So I think there are many, many predictive algorithms that already exist in people's lives. And then there are also algorithms that affect you on the help side, where algorithms are now used to detect, for instance, put likely tumors in in breasts, mammograms, for instance, and really advancing of what humans and machines can do together. So oftentimes there's a human expert involved, but machines are just way faster and going through massive amounts of data, identifying potential likely problems, and then experts coming in and confirming that this really might be the beginning of a tumor, and then maybe doing follow-up studies there. And similarly, you could do similar algorithms running over, for instance, learning data, running over scientific data, or over technology data. And oftentimes that is done. And many of the examples that I found particularly useful and valuable and insightful and actionable are covered here in the book. And the actionable part is actually very important to understand. So there are many models out there which do change minds. People have, after seeing them, a very different understanding of their world. They understand it better. They realize that their previous understanding was wrong, incorrect, imperfect, or partial. Now, with this new understanding, they might or might not be able to do something. So, for instance, A policymaker might very well understand that something needs to happen, but might not be in the position or have the authority or ability to implement what is actually needed. They might be able to talk to somebody who has that ability, but they themselves might not be able to do it. And so what we oftentimes do is to work extremely closely with decision makers to truly understand what they can and cannot do in their position, and to then give them algorithms and models and data visualizations that they can use on a daily basis to really help them understand their portfolio, if you wish, and also how it evolves over time so that they can proactively steer it, almost like coming to your office in the morning and seeing all of the things you care about on your screen, and you will get to see some that are doing great. They're all green and happy. And then there are some areas which are red, which definitely need your attention. And there might even be a blinking one, which really needs your attention right now. So I think having people get a more holistic understanding of these complex interdependencies that many of us are facing on a professional basis, and also understanding what new data sets and new algorithms become available and could be incorporated in our world, so to increase our understanding and to increase the models we have and we use on a daily basis, that's really a future that we all, I think, are going towards. The more people ultimately understand these models, the better we all will be off. Because if it's just computer scientists and engineers which understand these models, that's not good enough. I think we really need to have a much better understanding of models by anyone. And I think it's totally feasible because some of these models can be playfully explored. You know, you can just take your entire family on a trip. And again, NetLogo was already mentioned. There are many other online models that are really fun to just play with, and they will give you new insights. And many of them are mentioned in the book. And so I think it's a new way of just looking at our world and engaging with it so that we get to see what model to use when, what kind of visualizations works for one area but not for others, to kind of, with open minds and eyes, look in your environment where models are already used and you're touching them quite frequently, and engage in a discussion of how models could be used in your personal lives more efficiently, but also in your professional lives. I think that's where models really can shine, because oftentimes it takes larger databases and more compute power than you might have at home to really get some of the more complex systems understood and communicated.
Oh, that's an excellent illustration on how models can contribute to our society. So what discoveries along your journey to writing your book, Atlas of Forecasts, surprised you the most?
This is really interesting. So if you read through the acknowledgments, you will see that this book really has benefited a lot from many, many experts. And I was really interested to see how many models are out there developed by social scientists, economic and behavioral scientists, physicists, biologists, many, many sciences out there, almost every single science now has models. And it's interesting that whenever a new model is developed, it at some point, very soon later after that point of discovery, it's also applied to science, or it's also applied to technology developments, because people are curious to understand what we know collectively and what our expertise is. And so in many cases, you see a model come into existence in, let's say, economics, and then very, very quickly, it's also as applied to study the scientific data sets, such as papers, patents, grants, clinical trials, scientific data sets, news items about science. And then, of course, it creates new insights. It's slightly different data than the original domain had. And just the proliferation of this model application is quite fascinating to see. The other piece that I found really interesting also is that different teams which work on models, they really have very different setups. So for instance, the team by Dirk Helbing at ETH in Zurich, very different. Lots of really smart students and postdocs working on very specific projects together. Then I was at the KNAW in the Netherlands, the Königliche Akademie der Wissenschaften in the Netherlands. And that's a very different setup where there's a lot more queries that also come from different agencies and policy officials. And those queries have to be answered, and they're very practical questions that need to be answered. And then ultimately, I was also at the, I spent my most recent sabbatical at the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development in Paris. And it was a wonderful time in Paris. And there you have politicians and research experts and data experts from almost the entire globe come together in a very fruitful environment to really help each other understand how to best analyze and communicate this data to policymakers and researchers and many, many others, which have to understand the state of affairs of our global economies and science, technology, education environments, because there will be no innovation without education. There will be no science without proper education. So how does it all interlink, and what do we need to teach today to empower the generation that is now growing up so that they can do the innovation tomorrow? And so again, having all these different environments, which are all needed in order to advance science, technology, education, policymaking, is very quite fascinating. And so in the Atlas of Forecasts, you will see many, many examples that came from being in contact with these different environments. And you will also see that we held a number of meetings that brought together hundreds of experts to, in a very focused manner, discuss how these models can be advanced, how they can be better used, how they can be visualized and communicated better, how they can be introduced into teaching and research better. And ultimately, that gave me the ability to pick the set of models that you get to explore and have fun with in the book.
So if you could have one model that was really precise and really accurate, which one would that be?
I think you might not get that, sorry, but I think the best ways to understand our world is actually to not just apply one model, but maybe two models. If both models predict the same outcomes, that's much more powerful than having just one model. In the US, if you have a hurricane watch, you actually get the US model and the European model shown on TV. So you get two predictions in TV. So then you can pick your favorite model, or you can see in how far they agree or disagree. So I think similarly, in your normal life, it's actually quite useful to look at one problem from multiple vantage points. So coming back to the original question about how to pick good mentors, I think it's good to have mentors that come from different vantage points, different cultures, different lines of research, because they will hopefully get to advise you in a better way. And that's where it becomes so important to find a way to communicate across scientific boundaries. So again, you oftentimes, if you use words, it's not going to work, because we all have a very different understanding of what a prototype is, of what certain other terms refer to, etc. But if you use concrete visualizations, people can typically then find problems or find out things that just don't seem to be right, and they can start discussing this. Another way of bringing clarity are formulas. So if you have an audience that all can read and understand formulas properly, it's a great way to talk about and across scientific boundaries. So I think in my world, in the many, many application domains we have worked with, formulas or pseudocode or visualizations of data models, model runs, model setups, those are the two things that work. Just text, discussing things verbally oftentimes does not work necessarily.
Well, we've taken up a lot of your time. So can you tell us where our listeners can find more information on what you're currently working on and also about your book?
Sure. So the Atlas of Forecasts is, of course, available at the MIT book site. It's also available on Amazon. It's a great Christmas present, by the way, also, if you're already planning ahead. You can also then, if you like this book, you can, in the Amazon way, you can get to the Atlas of Knowledge, which teaches anyone on how to map. So that's really focusing on empowering everybody to have higher data literacy and data visualization literacy. Or if you want to go back in time, you can also get the first atlas, which is the Atlas of Science, which helps everyone realize that you can now map science and technology developments over time. You can map your career trajectory over the landscape of science. So those three books are now completed. That's the Atlas Trilogy, as we call it. Going forward, we are part of a very exciting project that is aiming to map the human body at single cell resolution, an atlas of atlases, of tissue atlases. And that project is funded, the pod that I'm part of is funded by the National Institutes of Health. And there is another effort, the Human Cell Atlas, that has many other funders as well and is highly international and creates a wonderful research environment for many young and senior experts to work closely together across disciplinary boundaries to map the 33 trillion, I think is our best guesstimate of the number of cells in our body. So this project is going forward, and I think there will be another atlas coming for that, but that will take us a while. So thank you again for the interview. And if people want to look at interactive maps, please do go to scimaps.org. So sci like science, and then maps like maps, and .org. And if you go there, you will get to see 100 maps of science technology, and also many, many interactive data visualizations. And the 17th iteration of this exhibit, so we have been doing this for 17 years now, will come into existence very shortly. So watch out on the Twitter feed and on the Facebook channel we have for the exhibit. And there's a lot of new cool data that got mapped during the pandemic time, but also new ways to really represent data in a way that anyone can understand it and ideally use it to do better decision-making in their personal and in their professional lives.
Oh, that sounds super interesting. Well, thank you so much for joining me today. It has been really a fascinating discussion into the world of data.
Thank you.